Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Cyber Security Recruiter Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dustin Heath. How you doing, my man?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here.
Good. Yeah, nice to have you on. For everyone listening, it's like proper post-COVID, like podcasting. I think you used the word startup vibes, Dustin. We've had a few technical issues, mate, haven't we?
Yeah, you'd think we'd have all of this web stuff dialed in by now. After COVID, everybody's doing it, but I feel like every other call ends up being some kind of hiccup.
No, it's good, mate. Listen, you showed a proper hacker mindset there, mate. You didn't give up. Like, there was two or three times where you could have easily given up there. For everyone listening, we've been at it, I say about, I think it was 37 minutes to be precise. So we're faffing around. Dustin did not give up and we got there. So there you go.
Looking forward to this conversation for a while. I know we've had to reschedule a couple times. And yeah, great to be on with you today and looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, likewise, mate. For the listeners that don't know you, Dustin, I'll just do you a brief intro. If I get anything wrong or anything's missed out, feel free to shout at me, my friend. But going back as far as 2008, you were a project analyst, which you did for almost 5 years. Then you took the major leap into basically being the founder and co-founder of Vigilant Cyber Systems. And that is a business that you've ran now for, again, almost 12 years, about 11 and a half years. Yeah. Welcome to the show, mate.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, graduated from undergrad in 2008. Wasn't really sure where I was going from there. 2008 was a difficult time to graduate from undergrad, the middle of a financial crisis, and the economy was in chaos. And I went to a couple of career fairs and I'd always been interested in contracting and business management, and landed on working for a Navy contractor doing IT retrofit for Navy destroyers. Actually, it was an IT contract I was doing project management on, and then rolled from there into DARPA up in Arlington, Virginia, and worked on a bunch of research and development projects there at DARPA. That's where I met my business partner, Dr. Mike Shields, and we were working on a program there called the National Cyber Range, and we worked on that program from 2009 through 2013 together. And then in 2013, we decided it would be fun to start our own thing. And so we put Vigilant together and started going after some research projects. And yeah, it's flown by. I can't even believe it's already been 12 years. So
yeah,
it's been a good run.
Yeah, mate, it's really cool. And there's a few things there. Like, I definitely want to get into more of that, starting your own business with your co-founder and what's that like. And I'm sure there's been good times and bad times, and I'm sure over the last kind of 12 years, I bet it's all worth it now, but maybe at times it was tough. So it'd be nice to dive into that. But you mentioned 2008, and I can imagine into like the contracting world or the working world, you use the word chaos. And I bet there's a lot of people out there now, because the market's been really turbulent. Some areas are still good, but there's a lot of layoffs and stuff still. In 2008, when it was tough, like, did you cope? How? I'm sure it was a bit scary, but is there any kind of thing you did back then to help you progress that could help people listening now?
Yeah, one thing that I had the benefit of is ignorance, which I think was like a major benefit, because I was just coming out of undergrad for the first time in my life. I didn't know, and nobody really knew in the moment, what is this thing? What is this financial crisis? How long is it going to last? What's going to be the impact? We just took it one day at a time. So I was just out there on the street looking for what I could find. And at the time, I only knew, man, this is weird. This is a whole exciting new world. And I need to find a job, just like I always knew I would need to find a job after I graduated undergrad. But it didn't feel, in hindsight, now looking back, it's, man, you were trying to find a job in one of the hardest job markets ever, like in the last 100 years, right? Like, you were literally trying to find a job in May of 2008 when the entire world was, the economy was collapsing. But at the time, it just felt, for me, it was May of my senior year, time to go get a job. And so just rolled up my sleeves and kept updating the resume. And I did have to be, I would say that I did have to be a little bit more open-minded and a little bit more flexible to get my foot in the door. I think going into undergrad, had a lot of ideas about what I wanted to do and be, and those kind of evolved over time. But one of the best things that I did was not be too dialed into the exact thing. I've got to go find this one specific role for this specific company. I was a little bit open-minded in terms of, I just need to get in the door somewhere and I can evolve that position and evolve that skill set as I'm working through my career. And that ended up being, you know, amazing for me, because I don't think I ever would have picked going and working for a Navy contractor in, at the time, in that first job was in Lexington Park, Maryland. And none of those things were on my top bucket list of places to be or jobs to do, but it ended up being what I was able to get started on and made some amazing friends and got my foot in the door. And then from there, once I was in, I was able to see where I could pivot or see where I could grow or see what skills I could evolve. And so that would be some of my feedback to someone who's in that position where they're feeling a little down, feeling a little unsure of where to go next. It's like, just do something, you know, just start by doing something. And then, you know, the worst thing you can do is just sit around and do nothing, you know, so just go in one direction. And if you find out that you have to pivot and go somewhere else later, that's fine. But at least you're moving.
Yeah, man, I love that. It's almost like we've got too much information these days and too many options. And you can, it's true, you can sit there and do nothing and look at this and you're checking your newsfeed, you're checking social media, you're seeing this, you're seeing that. I think it's a big reason why so many people get anxiety these days. It's almost like we know too much. It's like when you're looking for technical information online, there's that much. It's almost like knowing where to go because there's just stuff everywhere. But yeah, ignorance is bliss, mate. It definitely worked for you then.
Yeah. And now that I'm on the recruiting side or the hiring side, that's something that we look for all the time. One of our key questions that we ask for in interviews is, tell us about a project that when we're hiring out of school or new hires, tell us about a project that you didn't have to do for class. Like you didn't have a professor telling you to do it. What, like, give us an example of a project that you did, a coding project or a cyber project or something that you went out on your own and did for fun. And I think it's one of the most important recruiting questions we ask, because there's so many people that it appears to us now is like, hey, look, I've heard you make a lot of money in cyber, or I've heard you make a lot of money in IT. That's what I want to do. And that's why I'm doing it. And it's nobody wants to hire that person. Nobody. That is the person that we're screening out. Like, we are doing everything we can to try to screen that person out of our process. Like, we want the person that is passionate about the technology, passionate about the they don't just have one project they've done. They'll talk to you for an hour about the projects they've done. That person goes to the top of our list when that's the answer we're looking for. So that's tagging on what I said before. And a lot of those things, those aren't paid jobs that we're asking for. Those are, hey, I went out online, I found a CTF, or I went out online and I found a cyber club or a cyber problem, and I worked on it on my own, unpaid, just because I'm passionate about the field. And now I've got this great story to tell in an interview. And it's, man, honestly, the time that you spent on that project was probably worth $300 an hour, $400 an hour, because now you've got a great story to tell in an interview.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that, Dustin. And thanks for saying that, mate, because I think people need to hear it. And you're right, mate, for everyone listening, if you're in it for the money, listen, there's easier ways to make a lot of money. If you're on the hacking side, you better be keeping up because it moves really fast. If you're on the defensive side, to be in a defensive, hackers never strike at a convenient time. I think there's much easier ways to make money. You've got to be into it.
Yeah. The great thing about cyber is, it's such an active community with a lot of passionate people. It's never hard to find meetups. It's never hard to find conferences to go to. There's B-sides all over the place. You can go to small local conferences, and then there's some amazing large. Obviously, there's the Black Hats and the DEF CONs, and there's just so many great places where you can go. And it's just filled with passionate people that are doing these villages or doing these setups, and you can just go and network with them. It's a very accessible. After having spent 12 years, 15 years in this industry, it feels very accessible. It's not really sterile. It's a very roll your sleeves up, get in front of a keyboard, check out what I'm doing, look over someone's shoulder kind of community. And so, yeah, I would encourage people, if you're not sure, if you feel like you're stuck, you're not sure what to do, go to some of these B-sides conferences. They're not expensive. $100 gets you in the door. $100, $200 gets you. You don't have to go buy a $5,000 Black Hat ticket, although that's great too. It's accessible. It's an accessible community to get plugged into, I think.
Yeah, it is. And I've said this before on the pod, Dustin, and not to say anything bad about the finance sector or anything like that, but I'm sure, like, people in finance or accounting, I'm sure the community is not like it is in the security community. There's no, like, and if you're into it and if you're in it for the right reasons and your intentions are good, you're right. Everyone is, like, really welcoming. If you're not sure about stuff and you want to learn stuff, even as a recruiter, when I first started, if people thought, yeah, do you know what, this guy seems like, people will help you. They enjoy it. And you tend to find people at the more senior end of the market that have done pretty well, or founders or business owners, a lot of people are at the stage where they want to give back a bit. So if you're making the right moves and your intentions are good, I think people are definitely there to help, mate, aren't they?
Yeah, just don't be shy to ask. I always say nobody ever won the lottery without buying a ticket. You know, I tell that to my guys all the time, especially in relation to conferences, because it's easy to go to the conferences and sit back and just listen to the talks and not put yourself out there, not shake hands, not network, not get engaged, not ask questions at the booths. A lot of times it's easy to just be passive, but the more you're willing to put yourself out there, the more hands you can shake, the more business cards you can swap, the more communities you can actively get involved in and contribute to, you're going to get a 10x return on just being a consumer if you're a participant. And yeah, have that participant mindset. You're going to get a ton out of those conferences.
You are, mate. And I love that. And it's like what you said earlier, like that free project you did was worth $300 an hour. You're going to 10x your time back by going to the conferences. I think the worst thing people can do is almost negotiate the price in their head along the way and go, oh, is it worth it? Is it worth it? If you just switch off, trust the process, don't worry about the time, don't worry about doing bits and bobs for free. Just go out there and just literally dive in head first and don't worry about anything. And you'll look up in 3, 4, 5 years time and you'll probably be doing pretty good.
Certainly in this industry. Yeah. The people that are passionate about it separate pretty quickly. And it's also, I think one of the really cool things about cyber is it is a ruthlessly technical industry. Soft skills, of course, are important everywhere, but the people that actually know what they're talking about when in a technical position versus the ones that don't, they're very discerning. People that know what they're talking about are very discerning because there's just a lot of people that are out there saying buzzwords. Yeah. And in my experience, cyber people are pretty, they are open if you're genuinely curious, but if you're trying to fake them or you're trying to throw a bunch of buzzwords around and pretend and you talk about stuff that you don't actually know what you're talking about, it's a ruthlessly critical industry for that stuff. And when you're into learning and growing and you're actually learning the things, you're going to stand out really quick because there honestly aren't that many people. There's a lot more people that are just want to go at the surface level and are in it for the money or are just on cruise control or whatever than there are the people that are actually getting into like exploit development, for example, or reverse engineering. People that are actually going into some of those hard, fine technical skills. Like when you find someone who like actually does exploit development and you get them talking, it's like, oh, you're a rare person to find. Like someone that is actually building these things and isn't just kiddie scripting and going on Kali and just hitting a button and using a GUI. Like people that are developing exploits from scratch, there's not that many of them, honestly. Like yeah, as a percentage, there's just really very few.
You're right, mate. There isn't. Dustin, when it was really interesting, about 5 minutes ago, you started talking about one of the first questions we ask in terms of your hiring is what projects have you done that you didn't have to do? What did you do outside of college or school or stuff like that? Obviously, you're screening for people that are just in it just for the money. What else are you looking for? So for business owners hiring, what are you looking for to build a really good business? And for people listening that want to get hired, what are you looking for as well?
Yeah, so I think we screen probably more heavily than a lot of our peers, I would say, on academic credentials. There's a couple reasons for that. One is my business partner has a PhD in electrical engineering, is very academic in nature, and he really does place a lot of value and a lot of weight in understanding the academic state of the art, in having provably correct solutions, in being very precise. And that is one area that we screen on. We look for people coming out of good schools, with good programs, with good reputations. I know there's a lot of push right now on just doing online certifications and going the Coursera route, which there's nothing wrong with. There's a reason that there's a lot of push. Google has their school that they're putting out for a lot of cyber skills. Nothing against that at all. I think that's great. You can learn a lot there. But I just personally, for us, we look pretty heavily at a good undergraduate degree. That's the baseline of where we start hiring from is a good, solid, good grades from a good school undergrad degree. And then for entry-level people, that's pretty much it. That's we're recruiting from schools that we know and trust. We have relationships with professors. We're recruiting through a warm pipeline where the professors are giving us names of people that they trust and we trust them. And that's probably the biggest barrier, I would say, for someone who is looking to break in. You have to find a way to establish trust as quickly as possible with your hiring manager or your recruiter or whoever it is, because that's the, I would say it's probably more important than the skills. what I'm looking for is someone that I can trust and someone that wants to learn and someone that has aptitude. The skills I can teach, but the trust piece that you're going to work hard, that you're going to have high ethics, high integrity, like that, like honestly, that's a bigger piece of why we hire people that are coming from good schools that have bachelor's degrees, because those schools are hard. Yeah. You know, it's a computer science degree from a good school. It's not just the skills you learned. You had to work your butt off for 4 years to get that degree. If you have good grades coming out of a good school, it's not just what you learned. It's the thousands of hours that you had to put in to get those grades. And I think sometimes that gets lost, honestly, in this noise of just go get some certs and throw your resume out there. If that's the situation you're in, nothing against it. Absolutely do it. It's fine. And we've hired people like that and had great experiences with them. But I would say, if you're in high school and you're debating your options, or even in undergrad and you're debating your options, I would say stick it out, put the work in, get the degree. That's a high value add for us. Mm-hmm. And then after undergrad, there's the big certs. OSCP is a huge one right now, the gold standard for us and for all of our customers. The government likes to see some more of the junior level certs, ethical, certified ethical hacker, mm-hmm. P, CASP, Security Plus. Those are ones, if you're going into work for the federal government, that a lot of the contracts are going to require you to have. Yeah, I would say undergrad degree and certs is the baseline. That gets you in the door. That kind of gets you the interview. And then once we do the interview, like I mentioned already, that one question that we ask, but really all of the questions that we ask are centered around that concept of, are you a hardworking person that has good ethics and good integrity? And are you teachable at a junior position? As you get more senior, we really are looking, because we're going to slot you in directly into a team. And if we're hiring a mid-level or a senior level person, then they're going to be in charge of junior level people. And so just being teachable at the mid or senior level isn't really good enough. You have to be a teacher. And you also have to know your stuff, because it's really bad for culture when you bring in a third party outside person that comes in as a middle or senior manager and the junior level people know more than they do. The junior level people generally are initially skeptical. And in this field, especially, there is definitely that hacker mindset of, I'm just going to put my hoodie up and stare at you from the corner and give you a chance to hang yourself, like, and say something stupid. That is absolutely a real thing. And so there is a little bit more like emphasis, I would say, on mid-level and senior level people to just be really sharp and to be able to demonstrate that experience with hard skills.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Justin. And there's loads there. Really interesting to get your insights there in terms of how you're thinking when people are coming aboard. And the two big things I got, obviously there's certain schools you like and things like that, which I get. And there's certain people that will be in that position. There's certain people that aren't. But there's two words which are commitment and trust, and like sticking to something for a length of time and you seeing that someone's got that. So if it's from the schools, great. But if it's turning up to conferences on a regular basis, making connections, building relationships, and I think understanding that none of this stuff happens overnight. I think people expect to maybe do some kind of boot camp, rock up, have a few conversations, bang, they're straight in. But I know social media makes it all look like that, but the reality is these things do take time and commitment, and building trust takes time as well. You can't just do it in a day, like, or a month. It takes a bit of time, mate, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I really don't want to disparage that track either. There's a lot of people I understand, like, financing undergrad and grad schools is really expensive and it's not really in the cards for everybody. So I don't want to be discouraging the people that need to go a different route. But yeah, conferences are great for that. Certs are great for that. Doing those online projects, there's tons of bug bounty programs are great. There's a lot of things you can do to throw on your resume that show over time that this isn't something you're just doing on a whim. And I would say, so specifically for people that aren't really looking at doing the full 4-year CS degree, but are interested in cyber, one of the things that we've seen that kind of holds people back when we've interviewed people that have gone that route, so this might be a blind spot that you could work on. One of the things that a good CS program in undergrad is going to focus on is like a really thorough understanding of networking, a really thorough understanding of programming languages, scripting languages, things like that. So that when you show up and you're trying to navigate, you know, the different tools and you're trying to go through the different steps of a pen test or a CTF, you have these building blocks that are really thorough. And the reason that thorough understandings of those things matter is because when you're actually doing a pen test or a CTF, it's not the common low-hanging fruit stuff that's going to get you the flags that win or that's going to get you the vulnerability. It's the niche one-off thing that you have to like problem solve your way to. And you can't problem solve your way. It's like you can't find your way through a cave if you don't have a flashlight. Mm-hmm. It's like it's going to take you 10,000 times more time than someone that has the flashlight. So you have to understand scripting languages. You have to understand Linux. You have to understand like some of these core technologies that get taught in undergrad, but maybe that some of these boot camps don't necessarily spend enough time on, right? Because the boot camps want to teach you tools. They want to teach you Metasploit. They want to teach you like Wireshark. They want to teach you whatever these tools are, but it's like, yeah, you need to have a fundamental understanding of like how networking works before you're going to be able to get anything valuable out of Wireshark or some of these. Unfortunately, we see that a lot. And that's what's our feedback to those people is, hey, it's great that you did these boot camps and that you got these certs, but there's some pretty big fundamental building blocks that you need to go back and learn. You don't have to go to undergrad to learn them. You can do Coursera classes. You can do Google classes. You can do MIT has a lot of their CS classes for free online. You can do them for free, but you got to put the work in to learn the material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, thanks, man. Listen, I've heard this before. So many interview questions are, okay, so you use that tool, tell me how that tool works. And so many people can't, like I say, so many people can't do it. And it's getting those fundamentals. Like I say, how can you do a network pen test if you don't understand how a network's set up? You just can't.
You can boot up Kali and you can start hitting buttons.
Yeah.
And you hope they work. If stuff doesn't work, you're like, I guess I'm just going to try something else.
Yeah.
And that's the separation from the kiddie hackers to the people that are actually going to build a career is they have to, there is that element of hacking, like you said, like today, where you just can't give up and you got to keep trying different things. That's absolutely an element. But there's also this other element of you have to have the mental fortitude to stick with something and learn everything there is to learn about it. And sometimes those are contrary to each other, right? There's that, I'm just going to try everything and quick and break everything, like hacker mindset. But then there's this other side of the people that are really good, the really good testers that is disciplined, that is academic, that is methodical, like understanding all of the underlying technologies, understanding not just how to use the tools, but why do the tools work? How are the tools built? And if you're just trying to run in and break stuff and run out and you don't take all that time, what happens is when you get into a larger pool and in a larger competitive environment, you're only going to be able to go so deep. Mm-hmm. And you're going to run in and you're going to break a bunch of stuff, but everybody else already knows how to break those things that you're going to break. Mm-hmm. And it's the guys that take the time to really understand the underlying tools and technologies that are going to go to all the way to the bottom of the pool, which is where all the money is. That's where all the flags are. That's where all the vulnerabilities are. That's where the best pen test reports are, right? Yeah. Is the hard stuff that no one else can find.
Yeah, it is, mate. No, thanks, mate. And I think as well, Dustin, it's like a lot of it is about having that longer term mindset and looking at things over longer time horizons. Because if I break down what we've been talking about, so what you're doing outside of work, bug bounty, getting the fundamentals, maybe coming up through the sysadmin route, understanding networking, understanding programming, understanding what tools do, not taking any shortcuts, conferences, attending, building up trust. If someone's just trying to fast track it, that's probably all going to sound really daunting. But if you go, hang on, I'm in this for the long run, where am I going to be in 3 to 5 years? Where am I going to be in 5 to 10 years? If you start looking over those longer time horizons and breaking it all down, it's all very doable. And like you said, methodical approach, longer time horizons, I think it will all seem less scary then. And if you just be realistic about how long some of this stuff's going to take. But yeah, mate, cool. No, it's nice. You've given us loads there, mate. Else in terms of getting mega, essentially?
I think the one thing that we see a lot of on resumes that is probably worth mentioning is there's a lot of, I call them either defensive focused or IT focused, that are working help desks, that are working in IT, in networking, which is a great background. Like I've mentioned before, there's a lot of fundamentals that you learn on that side. And they have an interest in pivoting over and doing pen testing. There's a ton of people in that boat. 5, 10 years of experience on the defensive side, IT side. They haven't really done a lot of offense, but they're interested in getting over there for the latter half of their career. And it's as someone who has built and runs an offensive cyber company, though, it's really important when that, if that is you and that's your resume and that's your circumstance, that you have some offensive stuff to show. It doesn't have to be paid stuff. It doesn't have to be job stuff, but go do some capture the flags. Go do some bug bounties. Go do something that shows that you're not just thinking about things from a patch maintenance perspective, right? You're not just thinking about things from a defensive perspective, but that you are able to find that vulnerability, that you are able to, the complaints that we've done lots of pen tests for lots of people. And almost always when you go and brief your pen test report, you're briefing it to a bunch of IT people that are, that's their role. You came in to test the system and it's their role to maintain the system. And inevitably, every single time we go to brief findings and they say, this is what we did. And they say, there's no way you did that because the system doesn't let you do that. It's not supposed to let you do that. It's like, that's the whole point. That's the whole point of why we're here. You thought that the rules of the system or the documentation or whatever say that the thing should work this way. And if that's your mindset, right? If that's how you go through your understanding of computers and your understanding of networks is whatever the documentation says must be true.
Yeah.
You're going to be a great IT person, but you're going to be a terrible pen tester. And so you have to show that you've been able to flip the script on that and say, oh, let me look at this documentation. Oh, it says that the system can only do this through this. What would happen if I tried to do this? What it says that it can't do that, but what if I try it? What if I pretend that I'm this and then I come back at it and do this? Like that, you have to have, and it's shocking how many interviews I've done where you start to get into some of those questions with people that really want to make, they've done some boot camps, they've done some certs, they really want to make the switch over, but you start getting into any levels of questions like that and it's just like, you can tell they've never even thought about it from the offensive perspective. They've just spent a career thinking about it from the defensive perspective, so... Yeah, go do some CTFs, figure out how to flip the script, have some really good stories for interviews, and you can do it. Like, you can absolutely make the jump, but yeah, it's really important.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Yeah, so for everyone listening, it really is a case of just leaving no stone left unturned. And you mentioned there about the bug bounty and about the projects again. I call that making the resume 3D. I think I see this all the time with clients we're hiring for. People, they want to see stuff on Reddit. They want to see projects. They want to see GitHub repos. They want to know how you built your home lab when you had no money and what you could do building a home lab for basically next to nothing. They want to know what you're doing after work, before work. All these things really matter because, like you say, it demonstrates that commitment, true passion, and things like that. And for people listening as well, if you do get all these things, like all the things like speaking, fundamentals in the background, like you mentioned, Dustin, the bug, but if you get all this right and then you stay in the industry for a long time and you get to a senior level, it doesn't matter what the market's, you're always in demand. Like those guys or girls that have got all these boxes ticked, like they are always sought after. Like you're putting a force field around your career and you're having a lot of fun as well and getting a lot of stimulation.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm so proud of the retention we've been able to keep in the company. It's probably the thing that I'm proud of the most because it means that we have a culture that people want to stick around and they're not looking to use us as a stepping stone or jump on, but they buy into the long-term vision of the company. But I have to fight for that. Like we, as soon as our guys have 3 to 5 years of experience, a degree, an OSCP, literally, as soon as they hit OSCP and they put that on the resume, they are getting hit up on LinkedIn by recruiters 10 times a week. You will never, ever, if you get 3 to 5 years of pen testing experience on your resume and you have OSCP, like you will never need to look for a job. Recruiters will reach out to you to find you. That's just the reality. So it's, yeah, put your time in, get in there and get your experience and get your certs. And it's a great field once you hit mid to senior. Well, yeah, definitely. Once you hit mid to senior level, you're going to make great money.
Yeah.
You're going to be in demand. The industry is not going anywhere. It's exploding. And so, yeah, it is. It's definitely worth it. The price at the end is definitely worth it.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, mate. Just, I want to jump over to the business side. Talk to me about setting up your own shop with your co-founder. Like, how did it happen? What was it like? Is it as hard as it? Would you have done it if you didn't know how hard it was now?
Yeah, it's funny. I was just talking to someone yesterday about this, but I definitely don't think I would do it alone. It's been one of the greatest joys of my life, honestly, to be able to do this with Mike. And we always joke that we're both married, but it's like a work marriage, starting a company with someone else. It's got a lot of, you have your ups and downs, and sometimes you're short with each other. And sometimes you've worked together for so long that you just, like, as soon as you start the phone call, you're like, oh, you're stressed out, or you're in a bad mood, or it's going to be a good day, or it's going to be a bad day. It's within 10 seconds of when you get on the phone. Maybe I'm not going to bring that thing up, or maybe now's a good time to bring that thing. So you just read each other's minds. But yeah, it's been great. Mike actually had started the company as a independent consultant, and he had hired a couple interns. But in 2013, he approached me and we talked about, hey, rather than this being just him, basically, do we want to hire some people and go after some different types of work? And so we started with the two of us and his wife, Cindy, and got some interns the next summer and ended up hiring a couple of those people full time, one of which is still with us, which is amazing. 12 years later, Jake, we hired him right out of school and he's spent the last 12 years with us. And then there's been a lot of interns and people through the years that have just come and gone, and we've been able to follow them. And it is, if he's my work wife or whatever, or work husband, then we think of all of these people that have come through as that, like the work kids, basically. If you had that opportunity to touch that person for that one summer, to give them 3 months of experience and feedback, whatever, and then they go on and do amazing things and go work for amazing companies and have these amazing careers. And that's by far the most rewarding part of the whole thing. All of the crazy long hours and the just having to constantly be the engine and pushing everything as a founder. You just have to constantly just keep driving no matter what, even when that's the most exhausting part. Is you just feel like, sometimes you feel like, man, if we don't keep driving this thing, is everything just going to come off the tracks or not? But it's all worth it because you see all these people that come and go. You see these lives changed. The employees that you've had for a long time grow up. You watch them get married and you watch them have kids and you watch them go through the years and you realize, man, this is able to do life together and have this impact. And that's what makes it all worth it, is the people that you're dealing with.
Good. It's that feeling of building something, mate, isn't it? It's a different level of drive altogether, I find. It's really good fun. Really good fun.
Yeah. It's scary. Like, I started my first 5 years working for a massive defense contractor, Mantech. They have billions of dollars and thousands of employees. And that was great because it was structured. I had an amazing mentor and boss that kind of knew exactly what she was talking about. And she gave me all this structure and this understanding of how the defense industry works and contracting works and cyber works and IT works and how they all interplay. And, but it was known, you know what I mean? Like they had strategies and they had procedures and they had expensive third-party consultants and they had all the budget in the world. And you just go from this situation where there's all these resources and all this structure into sitting in a basement with your business partner. And it's like, can we afford? No, we can't. So let's just set up a card table. Can I get a laptop this year? No, like you're going to have to use your 4-year-old laptop. And you start with nothing. We literally started with, we didn't even have enough. It was like every month, it was like, how much money? It wasn't like, how much do you work? What's your salary? It's like, how much money do you need to buy groceries? Oh, you need $3,000 this month to buy groceries? Okay, that's what you get. This is like this month. So it doesn't matter how much you work or what your hourly rate is or any of that. It's like, just what do you need to survive? And then you build that up. You get a couple wins, and those first couple wins are crazy. You get the first win, even though it's tiny in comparison, right? It's $30,000 or $50,000 or whatever. And you're going out to dinner, you're high-fiving, you're going crazy. And then you slowly build from there and you get more people and it's fun, but it's different. And then now at our size, we're at 30 employees. It does feel different. We don't celebrate like we used to when we get a $50,000 contract or you settle into new routines and new expectations. But similar, like I have 4 boys, 9, 5, 2, and then a newborn.
Wow.
And like the way I parent my 9-year-old is different than my newborn, obviously, and my 2-year-old, but I'm much more physical. My newborn, all I do is just hold and rock my newborn. I don't really hold and rock my 9-year-old, but it's different, but it's still great, if that makes sense. Yeah. And I think that has been the journey of doing this with my partner, is like over the last 12 years is the beginning felt really new and vibrant. And now it doesn't feel as new and vibrant, but it still feels like amazing that we've been able to build this thing that's lasted this long, that's impacted the hundreds of people that we've been able to impact between interns and family members and employees. And so, yeah, extremely rewarding. But I would highly recommend it to any of your listeners that are on the fence. I remember, you know, having a really stable job that I could have worked for a long time, good salary, great benefits, and just thinking like, but what if I did this thing? What if I took the leap? And it's scary, but it could be really cool and it could be really fun. And it would be fun to run it all myself and be able to be in the room when all the decisions are made. And yeah, I would have no regrets at all. I would do it again with a partner for sure. 10 out of 10 times.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, man. It's good. And having that, listening to you speak there, it's like you weren't thinking about the hours. You weren't thinking about the money. It was like, yeah, as long as we can get that. You just ultimate belief in the vision that you were going to get it to where it is today. And I think you people are setting up a business. It's highly relatable, but it's relatable to if you're breaking in. It's relatable if you're going through tough times in your midway through your career. If you just have that belief in that, goes back to what you said, it almost like blind faith, just powering through no matter what. Like when you broke in, blind ignorance, when you're starting your business, there was probably some there as well. You probably didn't quite know what you were letting yourself in for, but it probably helped.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Yeah. And you look back and you beat yourself up because, and they always say education is expensive no matter how you get it. And we've had some very expensive learning things. And it's easy to go back and beat yourself up about it and say, I can't believe we did that. I can't believe we didn't hire that person, or I can't believe we passed on that contract or did this or that. Sometimes you mess up. Like you really should have hired that person. You really should have done that thing. But the fact that you didn't is a learning experience, and you can always learn and grow and improve. And you need to have that mindset, because if you just beat yourself up when you make a mistake or you lose a contract or you lose an employee or you lose, it can get really dark. It can get really daunting, but it's like, hey, you know what? I'm not gonna make that mistake again. Mm. I've learned that. Yeah, it costs $100,000, or yeah, it costs that employee, or it costs that relationship, or it costs that contract or whatever, but you know what? The next time it won't. Mm. And yeah, if you're going to do a startup, you have to have that shooter's mentality, right? In basketball, you don't think about when you miss, you don't think about how many times you missed. You think about the next time you're going to make it. It doesn't matter if you miss 10 in a row. You think about the next time you're going
to
make it.
Justin, just to get a little bit granular with it. So if I'm listening, I'm thinking, yeah, it sounds frightening, but it does sound amazing. I'm like senior pen tester, head of whatever, been in the game for ages, like I could do it on my own, maybe felt like I could really want to get out. You sat there with your partner, you're on the laptop, you've got no clients, like how? What goes down at that point to get it rocking? Like what you look at each other and go, where are we going to get our first client? Like how does that work?
Yeah. So you certainly didn't do that. And I would be, I don't know that I would recommend doing that, like jumping in totally blind. I think there is a business planning component that really is very important. So stay in your stable job, do your business plan, vet your business plan with your partner and some other people while you still have a paycheck. And we certainly did that. Like we had a couple different markets identified. We had a couple different contracts and relationships identified that we were pretty sure we were going to be able to land. And then we jumped when we had that contract underway. And it was like, okay, we know that we've got this 1 year worth of runway on this contract or whatever. That's going to give us enough to get started. And then we have these markets that we knew we assumed we would be able to penetrate. Like, it's okay, we got this one thing that's going to pay the bills, keep the lights on. And then we've got these three other things that we think could probably turn into contracts relatively quickly if we put a bunch of effort in. And then you just go and churn. Like at the beginning, you just go churn. You churn that marketing plan as fast and as hard as you can to get that validation. And the whole time, especially at the beginning, the whole time you're doing that, you're doing product market fit the whole time. You're doing, what were my original assumptions? Are those changing? What were my assumptions about competition? What were my assumptions about our strengths or our weaknesses? Thought that the clients wanted X. Do they really want, we just had 10 meetings last week. Do we still think that they want X, or do they want Y? Can we do Y? Should we pivot to Y? And you're constantly having those conversations with your partner to figure out, And every single time you have a conversation, it's just like the failures and the mistakes, right? Every single time you have a conversation with a customer, even if they say no, that's a data point. Okay, why did they say no? We thought they would say yes going in. Also, otherwise, we wouldn't have had the meeting. But turns out they did it. Why didn't they? Was it too expensive? Was the timeline wrong? Was it a soft thing? Did they just not like us? Is our marketing pitch too aggressive? Is our marketing pitch too passive? Like, there's a million little things that you can tweak.
Yeah, there is.
And if you're constantly thinking about that and feeding that back into the system, then you will land somebody eventually. Like, you just got to keep tweaking that thing. And then once you get one, they say nothing starts until you get a sale. Like, nothing starts till you get a sale. Yeah. And so you just keep grinding until you get that sale. Then when you have a sale, now you can try to penetrate further. You can do referrals. You can do whatever. You can do a lot off of your first sale. But until you get the first sale, you just got to grind.
Yeah. And also, off a first sale, you've then got a story. You've got a real life case study. You've got something to showcase. And that's nice when you've got something there to leverage like that. That's what I found. It's
right.
Really nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like the feedback thing as well. I think that feedback thing is massive. And I think when you've got a relationship with a client and you've been engaged, you know what it's like. You get to know people pretty well, and you get some customers that really want that kind of like intimate relationship. Others just want to, in my experience, just want to do the job. Thank you very much. But ones where you can really get embedded with them, I think that feedback opportunity is probably one that gets overlooked. Like, you can probably learn a lot from. It's interesting about how did we approach you? Was it good? Was it too strong? I like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We talk about that, and I think about that a lot internally. It's just, we call it, I think this actually came out of an interview one time, but I was interviewing a guy, I think he was a Navy SEAL, and he was talking about, we were just talking about soft skills, and it was an interview. So we're talking, and he's like, in my squad, we used to call it the beer test. And it's literally, first of all, it was really the only thing that mattered. The only thing they filtered on. And it really didn't have anything to do with beer. Like, they didn't drink beer, but it was like, would you want to get a beer with this person?
Yeah.
That's literally it. Like, at the end of the day, like, they would bring someone in, they would sit around, they would ask them a bunch of questions, technical, non-technical, whatever. And then at the end, they literally would just go around the room and be like, would you want to get a beer with that? Is it a kind of person that you would want to get a beer with? And I love the simplicity of it, right? Yeah. Because it's just, it's everything all in one. It's, no, I wouldn't want to get a beer with him because he didn't know what he was talking about and he was full of BS. And someone else might be like, no, I didn't want to get a beer with him because he was arrogant and I like humble people and I don't want to be around arrogant people. Another person might not want to get a beer with him for a totally different reason. But at the end of the day, it's like, hey, we want a team of people that we all want to go get a beer with. So let's be okay reaching into that soft like thing, because the temptation, and we failed at this really bad in my opinion early on. The temptation in recruiting is like, quantify everything, right? What are the 20 skills that you're going to need that person to do? How do we come up with a skills test and a quantification or a level of questioning or whatever to go through each of those 20 and validate that those 20 skills they actually have? And you can do that till you're blue in the face. At the end of the day, like, you might find someone that has 20 skills, but then you didn't screen out this crazy red flag somewhere else that was like in their personality or in this other thing. And it's, you show up and you hire them, and then it's, whoa, yeah, they're really good at all 20 of those things, but nobody can work with them.
Yeah.
Or they are highly annoying, or they have no sense of project management and can never get anything done on time, or like any of these things. And it's, we should have screened for those things. And honestly, if we had just let our gut instinct come out a little bit more throughout the interview process, we probably would have caught it. But our interview process was so dialed into like screening for that specific stuff that we didn't really allow breathing room for just that beer test of, do you like this person or not?
Yeah.
Yes or no.
Plus, mate, you can't go for a pint after work with them.
Yeah, definitely.
Also, you mentioned their project management, and again, for everyone listening, and it sounds like you're on the same page here, Dustin, but like, those project management skills, those consulting skills, I mention this a lot on the pod, ability to articulate risk clearly, concisely, not just to technical people, to non-technical people, not to make non-technical people on the client side feel stupid if they are non-technical. All those things are huge skills, and probably you sounds like you underrated them when you first started and then like quickly realized that perhaps they are a bit more important. But for people listening, like, and especially people breaking in, they probably wouldn't have any clue how important all those things are, but they're massive, mate, aren't they, when you're dealing with end customers?
And the other thing that like that I see a lot of, it's just very frustrating, is if you're an expert at something, you can explain it to a five-year-old.
Yeah.
But everybody wants, the people that aren't experts want to go in and use a bunch of terms that people don't understand. And they want to go in and prove how smart they are by using all this like super technical jargon. The smartest people, the best leaders, the best visionaries, the best CEOs, they don't talk like that. Mm. They talk in a way that everybody can understand and everyone can. And there's a time and place. Like when you're in an engineering meeting and you're on a whiteboard, talk in the weeds. You got to get in the weeds. But there's a lot of times as a pen tester where you're briefing reports, where you're talking to management, where you're talking whatever, where you have to put that stuff away and still have a mastery of it to be able to communicate correctly the findings and the information. It has to be precise and correct, but it also doesn't have to be super technical such that people can't follow you easily.
Yeah.
And it's true. Think about all of the Steve Jobs effect and all of these great kind of visionary leaders that were master communicators at communicating very complicated things in a very straightforward way that could be easily understood. Mm. And that's especially in pen testing. We have that conversation all the time. Who cares if you found the number one vulnerability that blows everybody's mind? If you can't communicate that to the stakeholders on the client side, they will never fix it. You might have found the thing that will break their whole system wide open. If you can't communicate it to their IT team or their stakeholders in a way that they can understand and remediate, it doesn't matter at all. And that happens all the time. We've done that with so many clients. We give them this report and they have no idea, especially early on. As we've gotten more mature, we've gotten better about that. But if you're just dumping data out to your clients and you're just dumping findings out to your clients and you're not really thinking about who is my client? What is their level of ability to understand this? What are the things that they care about? What are their drivers? And then you're interpreting your pen test results into their key drivers and communicating to them at a technical level that they can follow and understand. Your report is not going to be the value is going to be significantly discounted.
Mm. Yeah, mate, 100%. And I find as well, Justin, if something is just layered and layered in complexity, I find the further up the ladder you go, like in terms of C-suite, if it's really complex, they're just like, it needs to be like clear, concise, simplistic, like I say, people just want you to get. I find the further the ladder you go, they just want you to get to the point as well, mate, don't they? They haven't got time for it.
And I'm not convinced that you have to go that far up the ladder. Like, okay. I think a lot of CISOs, a lot of IT managers, if they're using a third party pen testing company, they probably don't want to get a 60 page in the weeds report, even if they're in the weeds kind of people. Like, they probably want to know the bottom line up front. And how does it impact them and their stuff? What are the quickest paths to remediation? What are the major risks? These are at every level when you're reading a report, I feel like. And I understand. I've been in the room many times when we've been writing those reports. And that's some of the hardest stuff to write, right? Because what you want to do is you want to take all your data and take all your logs and take all your stuff and just copy and paste them into the report format and dump it in, right? And then provide a sentence or two of, this is what we did. Here's the outputs of the tools. That's what every tester wants to do. But it's like, I understand you want to do that because writing to management or writing to the key metrics that the stakeholders care about takes a lot of creativity and technical writing and work and translation. And now, admittedly, ChatGPT and a lot of these LLMs, they are really good at doing that exact thing. I think we are on the precipice of that level of tools being automated so that you can take really technical findings and the LLMs will just write the executive summaries.
Yeah, that'll make a lot of pen testers very happy, mate, because that's the bit they don't like.
Yeah, we've been playing with them, and obviously everybody in the whole cyber universe everyone's figuring out how to use them. But it'll be really interesting to see whether it's Rapid7 or I don't know, who it'll be that'll come out with the new method or the new tool. But yeah, whatever that pen testing tool is that has a really good tuned and trained LLM to take technical findings out of your Kali tools and your Metasploit tools and write executive summaries in an intuitive and like intelligent way, that's going to be a major tool. Yeah. Maybe it's already out there. Maybe you've used one, but.
Mate, I'm not sure. I mean, maybe, I mean, as I understand things, but I think it's getting better and better at the, it's just all moving so, so fast. But yeah, I think what AI is going to do, Matt, I keep saying it, I think it's just going to make it better. I think it's going to allow more time to get really good at the really stimulating stuff and essentially automate exactly what you've just described, the bit that probably most hackers don't really doing. That's what takes so much time to get it concise. Yes. It's not easy.
Yeah, we're in proposal writing mode right now, and that's, yeah, sometimes you have a 20-page proposal you're writing. Sometimes the requirements are a 5-page proposal, and the 5-page proposals are a lot harder than the 20.
Yeah, you'd have to just use smaller font, mate, and just cram it on 5 pages. Dustin, listen, it's been a good episode, mate. I always say the best episodes are, we've shot straight up to an hour. I've just not even really looked down at any prep or anything, mate. We've just freestyled it all the way through, and it's been really good, mate. I'll finish up with kind of what's next, mate. What's the future? What's the next few years like looking like for the business? Have you got visibility on your plans there?
Yeah, it's always a tension. We always live in the tension of setting expectations for growth so that you're always growing or you're dying. We always want to be growing. We also have such an emphasis at our company on quality of life and employees. We don't want to burn them out. We don't want to set crazy expectations that are going to demand people pull long hours away from their family and their kids or be on the road all the time. I think it's going to be more of a balancing act of that. We want to do sustained growth. I think that's what the phrase that we have settled into is, just sustained growth. And we've got some really great customers and clients that I'm hoping we can just continue to extend our services on. We've got a couple really fun new, we got a pen testing tool that we're going to hopefully start developing this spring that we've been internally working on for a while, but I think we're going to get a contract to build out, and hoping that contract comes through this year. And we've built a handful of tools over the years for very specific, like, niche military customers. Okay. But I think this tool is specifically for pen testing avionics and embedded systems, but it's probably the first tool that I think might have like actual commercial potential and have some legs to go do like a full-blown like marketing cycle on a tool. We've done, most of our revenue comes from service contracts, and we haven't done a lot of build a tool and then go sell licenses for it. But that may be in the cards for the next year. So that would be fun if we got that project off the ground. Mm. More of the same, probably hire a handful of people. And we, like I said, we're at 30 after 12 years. So we typically hire two to three people per year, pretty much every year. So looking forward to adding a couple more people into the fold. And yeah, that's what we have going on.
Yeah, cool. The tool, mate, that I think going on that tool journey, that'll be really fun. I've seen a few other companies do it, and it looks really good fun, that.
Yeah. I think if I were ever to, like, if, I don't know, for whatever, if whatever happened to Vigilant, if I were ever to start over and do another company, because we bootstrapped Vigilant, just Mike and I think that it would be really fun to have an idea for a tool, like a cyber tool, and then just go out and get VC and start with a board in place and VC backers in place and an exit strategy in place. Like, we started Vigilant just as, let's do this thing and ride it as long as we can. We're not going to borrow any money. We're not going to take any money on. We're just going to own it and run it, which has been amazing. But I am interested in there's this really big need in the market right now for this tool. Let's spend the next 18 months building the tool, and then let's spend the 3 years after that marketing it. And then let's sell the company after 5 years or something like that. Like, something that's like very constrained would be really fun. I think that would be a fun next project if I ever finish up at Vigilant. If I retire out of Vigilant in 20 years and had a great career building a company and working with people that I love, then that would be amazing as well. So Yeah.
Cool. Now, cool, mate. Listen, just, I know you're a busy man, mate. And so thank you for your time, buddy. And I really appreciate it, mate. And I think maybe you had to reschedule a few times. I think maybe once or twice it was my fault, once or twice it was yours. So even Stephen's on that one, mate. But it's nice to finally nail you down, mate, and get you in the virtual podcast studio. But thanks, mate. It's been really good. It's been really insightful. There's loads there for the listeners. Yeah. Thanks again, buddy.
Thank you for the invite. Yeah, look forward to continuing to chat with you and continuing to participate in this community. And yeah, I'm happy to answer questions, or if any of your listeners want to reach out or have follow-ups or want to connect, like, happy to do that. So yeah, I really appreciate the time.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Justin. If it's cool with you, mate, we'll get your LinkedIn profile in the comment section below so people can... Is that the best place to reach out, LinkedIn?
Yeah, LinkedIn is fine.
Yep. Cool.
Yeah, it's probably good.
Cool. All right, bro. Thanks, mate. Nice to see you, buddy.
Okay, thank you.